could we create this context in the church where it is safe to say, as I do in chapter one of the first book, this is my story, this is my song.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Conrad Konecny. He's a professor of sociology of religion at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania, and he's author of a series of books called A Church Dismantled, which is also the title of his podcast. We'll be talking about these books particularly and what he's been seeing about religion and faith as things are changing. And boy, does that not describe the last couple of years. And he has experienced this as a professor, as a sociologist, as a pastor, and in his own personal life. So I'm excited to have this conversation. I think you'll find it to be a helpful and interesting conversation as we navigate these changing waters of American religious life. And before we jump into the interview, don't forget that we do a lot more at Word and Way besides just Dangerous Dogma. You can find all that we're doing at wordandway.org. Particularly encourage you to sign up for our email newsletter, A Public Witness, original reporting and analysis to help you make sense of our crazy world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. Now here's my conversation with Conrad Konecny on A Church Dismantled. Well, Conrad, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, I'm excited to have a conversation with you. Last year, the most recent book came out in December, but you had a series of four books that came out, and I mean, I don't know what to call it. You kind of violated the laws of nature. We don't have a trilogy here. I don't know if it's like a quadrilogy, or I don't know what the proper, I'm sure there's a term.
I don't know either, because the fifth one's coming out in the spring called What in God's Name is Happening to the Church. So we're beyond the trilogy at this point.
Oh, okay. Well, if you get six, you can call it like a two trilogy, right?
There we
you
go. Know, there we go.
Get like Star Wars here. You start episode naming them and, you know, get up to nine or something, you know, a trilogy of trilogies. So, well, I want to talk about these books, and they share a common word and some other titles, but particularly this word dismantled. A church dismantled, ministry in a church dismantled, in a church dismantled, and then some subtitles that offer some different focus there. So let's start with that word dismantled. I mean, you know, and the some of the covers, you know, almost show like a church being dismantled physically, you know, brick by brick. So, you know, what are you calling for here when you're talking about dismantling the church?
Yeah, that's been a confusing question to people, I think, Brian, but I always had something in mind. And it went back to when I read a little book by Judson Cornwell, Pentecostal pastor writing, and I was 14 or 15, and I picked up his little book on Isaiah 40. And it just got into my, I don't know, my spiritual DNA, this idea that the Holy Spirit, that God's Spirit is up to some grand excavation project, lowering mountains, raising valleys, making rough places plain and crooked places straight. And that I could be part of that, that we were all invited into that. And it came back to me in 2006 when I did a study of Mennonite Church USA, my denomination. And I found in the stacks, I didn't know Walter Brueggemann's work, but in the stacks of our library at Elizabethtown College, I found his work on the prophetic imagination and on Jeremiah. And I immediately resonated with what he was seeing in the church, in the text, but in the church, and with the mess that I saw in the church and that our leaders acknowledged was in the church. And he uses the language of the dismantling, but not about the church. He uses the dismantling about the dominant culture and the subversive nature of the scripture and the subversive nature of God to tend to tear down the things that we build up. But it was only in 2020, when I started this podcast, The Church Dismantled, A Kingdom Restored, that I used the language. Actually, in 2012, I did a study of the Global South, churches in the Global South, and I used the language in that book called Winds of the Spirit. I used the language of a church dismantled. And for me, it's not destroying the church. It's about taking off those culturally or in sociological language, the socially constructed, taken for granted realities that we've covered up the church with, that we've covered up the truth with, Brian. That we always are constructing our reality socially, and the church does the same thing. Every social institution does this. And so what has covered up Jesus? what is it that we've mantled Jesus with? And so to dismantle is to take apart or take off those things that have covered up the truth about who Jesus is and what God's up to in the world.
I mean, this idea of you know, this mantling and you know, taking apart what the church has covered up about the truth, you know, that's, I mean, that feels like a little bit of a good historic Mennonite project. I mean, if you go back to the very beginning, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that tradition, you know, for our listeners. Sure. That may not be, sometimes there's some stereotypes that come up about Mennonites. Sure. And I was a member of a Mennonite Church USA congregation in Virginia for several years. So I understand some of the stereotypes that can come up. So I wonder if you can introduce us a bit to your faith community.
Sure. So in the Reformation, you know, there was the Lutheran side and the Reform side. And on the Reform side, Ulrich Zwingli had some disciples or students of his who felt like he had not gone far enough, that he really had remained committed to the state, particularly around the question of infant baptism, and that the question of infant baptism was really tied into taxation and support for the state and counting the number of kids. And it wasn't that baptism was not a commitment of the believer as an adult to Jesus. And so they have this conflict with him. They separate in 1525, January 21, three of them baptize one another as rebaptizers, and really to get at the core of who Jesus is. So Matthew 5-7 would be central passages to Mennonite theology. And we're not particularly creedal. So we were on the run for 200 years, for one thing, to escape the reformers who were after us. But we're really folks who were concerned with the mission of God, concerned of trying to live a life like Jesus lived, but not particularly interested in creedal statements, certainly not in the high scholastic Lutheranism that developed in Germany and around the Reformed tradition. So it was really sometimes called the Radical Reformation, really a reaction against the reformers who we were concerned did not go far enough in separating. I mean, some would call us the first separationists of church and state, because we were concerned that the state not be able to dictate to the church or not be able to mantle the church, as it were, with artifacts that were not relevant to who Jesus was and we understood Jesus to be.
Yeah, and you write in the books a bit about your journey in this tradition as well and how that has changed. And I wonder if you could talk about that journey for you in faith.
It is a pretty personal journey for me. In many ways, this dismantling of the church is a dismantling of, that I talk about in the book very personally. I think one of the things that has resonated with folks is a transparency of vulnerability that I reflect in the books. And I do it at several levels. I talk about the obsessive compulsive nature or experience that I had growing up, my terror of God, my terror of damnation, living with that, living a life where I lived in a valley that had road signs along the way that if, you know, believe in Jesus or you're going to hell. I mean, I grew up with saturated really with this kind of the sense that the love of God was not really connected to the Christian life or the Christian faith or to the church. And I grew up in a valley that was really an extension of an Amish culture that was pretty rigid and very strict, for one thing. All of the Mennonites in this valley came out of the Old Order Amish. So we had the DNA culturally, Brian, was quite strict. And so that fog of culture I grew up in, I was very sensitive to and struggled much of my life. I went to Wheaton College and found Martin Luther's Freedom of a Christian. And that was one of the first mantles that came off for me to reveal, you know, like Luther, who had struggled so much with God's wrath and damnation and so on. But more recently for me, it's been my diagnosis of Parkinson's disease that occurred 5 years ago, and which I had to come to terms with the fact that my body was being dismantled. And it took me a year of, you know, raging and tears and really being pissed off, but coming to grips with the fact that there was still hope, that God still had a direction for me to go. One of the most important lessons for me was going to Dale Chihuly's Glass Museum in Seattle. And Chihuly's this grand glass blower, and his museum is magnificent. But I saw on the wall this sign that said he had dislocated his shoulder and went blind in one eye. And he came to the point where he could no longer blow glass. So what he had to do was to actually paint what he saw in his soul for his students, who then did the glass blowing. And of course, those paintings now sell for thousands of dollars. But it was this gift that came to him of being able to pass on what was within his heart that before people couldn't see, they could only see the product. And for one who's a teacher and who was a pastor at the time, it was encouragement for me that there are always gifts in the dismantling. In fact, we cover up the gifts when we mantle them. And so losing my sense of independence has been a journey for me, but it's been an important one. And for me, kind of a prophetic or metaphor that I use for the church, saying there's great hope for the church if we allow ourselves to be taken apart by God's Spirit.
Yeah, you mentioned that you have been both professor and pastor, and we'll get to the pastor side in a moment. But let's introduce the professor side. Have been a professor of sociology, religion, and I wonder if you can. We've had a sociologist of religion, Nancy Ehrman, on the podcast before, but
sure.
I wonder if you can, you know, help people. What does that mean? How does that shape the way that you view the world, particularly the way you view the world of religion?
You know, it's interesting because as you know, I'm doing writing the unauthorized biography of Walter Brueggemann, and he was an undergrad sociologist at Elmhurst College in the 40s, early 50s. And so we connected immediately. I mean, his Old Testament work is so sociological. And to be a sociologist means that we always assume, Brian, that in fact, Peter Berger says this, the wisdom of sociology is that the world is not as it appears to be. That what we see to be Christian faith, or what we see to be religion, or what we see to be the church is not what it appears to be. That there always is something behind it. There's always something in the basement or in the second level or third level. The sociologist is always restless to say, what is really going on here? Doesn't everyone else see that the emperor has no clothes? And can't we try to understand what's going on? And so the idea that we are always pushing from often a critical perspective, many would say, and certainly Brueggemann picks up that approach, but we're loyal critics, I would put it that way. Loyal critics to the church. I'd like to be thought of as a loyal critic to the church, but one who's an honest critic. And so the sociological perspective also assumes, Brian, that we are always constructing our worlds, that the world we're dropped into was constructed by people, Berger says, often long dead now. But we assume that world, we absorb that world, we internalize that world, and that's where most of us stop. The next phase that Don Craybill, sociologist colleague of mine, and I created in that social construction of reality by Berger and Luckman was renovation, where we actually believe that there is some personal agency that we have to make some change. Now, Berger says we're really puppets controlled by puppeteers, but the first step towards freedom is to look up and see who the puppeteers are, but that most of us never look up. Most of us are just kind of content to live our lives and go through the motions. I have a Hindu colleague who says that most Hindus just want to live a life that's good enough to get into the next life at the same level they are in this life. And I thought, you know, sounds like an awful lot like Christian faith at times. You know, if I can just get into heaven, that's if I can just get that ticket. And so sociologists are always saying, what else is going on here? This doesn't smell right to me.
Yeah. And so then, you know, here you are, you're a scholar, you're publishing in academic journals about the sociology of religion. And then you also wind up as a pastor.
Yeah.
I wonder if you can share a bit of that story as well.
So Brian, I always assumed I was going to pastor, be a missionary. And then I was a week in college in the 80s. And I got turned on the sociology, and I was getting B's and C's until I hit Dr. Foss's methods course, and I just took off. And so then I started winning awards and publishing, and I said, oh no, now I'm at this crazy intersection of, am I going to do what I want to do or what God wants me to do? Of course, that was my, you know, the way I saw it. It's what God wants to do or me. And I had to come to terms with that God was leading me somewhere because of the gifts that seemed to be emerging. And so I went on to graduate school. And into the sociology of religion, and then to Elizabethtown College. And I always assumed that I would pastor. I'd retire at 55 from the academia and pastor. But in the year 2000, our congregation, our local congregation, asked me to be ordained and to lead our congregation. So I talked to my provost, who talked to the president. The president said, do we have to let him do this? The provost said, I think he's heard from God. I don't think we have any choice. And so, so I was given a kind of three-quarter time load at the college and half time at the church, and did that for 5.5 years. And then resigned from that to do a study of Mennonite Church USA. And then my wife and I were called back to the same congregation in 2011 and went back, but said, this time we're going back without a salary because we want to see, we want to try a missional experiment and see if we're not getting paid, we'll, because in the meantime, between the two ministries, I had watched a lot of other churches and recognized the churches that had vitality were those in which every member recognized that they were ministers, that the barrier between clergy and laity was lowered, was minimized. And so our goal was really to do that and lead in that way, to empower the congregation, to equip the congregation to lead. And I didn't need the income, fortunately. And so it allowed us to try to do that. And so we lasted 10 years and just resigned at the end of December.
Which means, and of course this comes up as part of the framing for your books, it means that you were pastoring at the start of the pandemic.
I was.
And if we want to talk about dismantling, you know, so much of our world and our view of the way things were happening, not just in church life, but in so many facets of our society, I mean, COVID is definitely a time of dismantling.
It is, Brian.
So I wonder if you could talk about that, particularly that experience pastoring at the start of the pandemic.
So at the start of the pandemic, I had just announced to the congregation that I felt like the Parkinson's disease was getting to the point where I needed to cut back from some of my responsibilities, and I would do that slowly. And then March, the pandemic came. And I just remember thinking, if I don't step up again, like, we're going to be swimming. And so I threw myself again into ministry. We had to learn how to go online, go virtual. But I also got really excited because I realized that sociology emerged 100 years ago as Europe was itself coming apart. And when the world comes apart, it allows us to see into that subterranean level that I talked about. And so I thought to myself, this is the richest time to be both a sociologist and a pastor, because we get to see into the underground. The world has just opened up for us. We get to see these geographical geographic levels that are of the church and society, and to investigate them, and then to start over again, to reset some things. So I got all excited as a pastor, and I did a resetting survey, Brian. It's my fallback, you know, do a survey. So
Likert scale and everything, right?
The whole deal. And analysis. And so we did a resetting survey. What do you want to reset? We've got this amazing opportunity. I think the struggle that I had was a struggle that many pastors I've talked to since have, was that the socially constructed world of church, Brian, got in the way of us. And I want to be sensitive how I say this, because it happened to so many of us, but it got in the way of our being willing to see what had opened up. Because what had opened up scared us. Looking over the edge of the abyss frightened us. The uncertainty frightened us. And with all of our hearts, we wanted to go back to what was normal. So I sometimes talk about it like a rubber band. You know, we stretched for so long, but we couldn't imagine that the rubber band wouldn't break. And if it did break, what would that mean for what we considered normative? And so we just wanted to get back to normal, whatever normal was. And I kept saying, but it's never going to be normal again. It's never going, we've stretched far and long enough that we're never going to be what it was. You know, you can't go home again. And I think that was the rub that I so often felt as a pastor, was believing that God had given us an opportunity, just like I believed Parkinson's disease has been for me an opportunity. I sometimes use the language, I do it subconsciously without thinking, but I'll say sometimes, when God gave me Parkinson's. And I say that because, in fact, I don't know how this is going to end. I know it won't end it probably in a very gentle way. But it has been transformative for me, Brian, in the way that I see myself, my life. It's focused me. I see the horizon ahead in a way I didn't see it. And I think COVID was an opportunity for the church to do the same. to get a new vision of God's eschatology. Where was God? Where is God leading us? And how can we allow this dismantling that COVID really accelerated to give us direction on this journey home? And I think, as with many pastors I've talked to, it was hard for our folks to get a hold of that vision.
Yeah, and it's been hard on pastors. I mean, you talk about this, particularly in the second book, Ministry in a Church Dismantled. You talk about the impact that COVID has had on pastors, on dealing with the feuds in the church, many pastors leaving the ministry or, you know, changing ministry context during this time. I mean, what has it been? What has COVID revealed that has shook up ministry and particularly has rattled a number of pastors?
I think it has revealed the polarization that was there already. I think it has revealed how individualistic our culture is and how that has integrated, how that has entered the church. Peter Berger talks about the continuum of community, integration, cohesiveness on one side, and individualism, individual freedom on the other. And he says every time the individual gains freedom, the community loses cohesiveness. And I think we weren't aware of how much cohesiveness and community we were losing over the last 30 years, that we've really become the mediating institutions of our society, like church and family and other, so education, have been tattered, maybe nigh to being annihilated. And so what we have is individuals and the state, with the mediating institutions very, very weak. When I talk with my students about the role of education in their lives, and I go back to Christian Smith's book, Lost in Transition, about millennials and the fact that students don't know what a moral dilemma is because no one's teaching them that, it's not their fault. But he's exactly right. The family, when I talk to my students, no one is talking with them about what's morally right. And I don't pretend to tell them, but I at least want to ask the question, Brian. So I'm always asking them the question, which is a deeply sociological question going back to Emile Durkheim in France 100 years ago. What kind of world do we want? What kind of world? Because if we can create a world, we can recreate a world. So what kind of world do you want, students? And what are your values going to be? So we talk about this chapter on sexuality. You know, they talk about the fact that they learned how to have sex in sex ed, but no one ever talked with them about should they have sex, or who should they have sex with, or why should they have sex. I mean, the moral conversations, Brian, are gone from the public square, and so we are left as individuals to feed off social media. I think the church often doesn't have these conversations. So, for example, this morning we talked about a chapter from my first book where I argue that I was talking with someone with Parkinson's and they said, don't let Parkinson's define you. And I said, you got to be kidding me. It has already defined me. You know, it's like, why would I deny something that's so much part of, clearly part of who I am? And then I happened to read this article from The New Yorker about Down syndrome's disappearance in Denmark. And that Denmark is creating a world, and it wasn't a judgment either way about abortion. It was simply that, what kind of world do we want? Do we want a world where there's no Down syndrome? Is that really the kind of world we want to create, where there's no disability? First of all, we can't create the kind of world, but that's the kind of world we're potentially are heading for. So I just ask my students that question, what kind of world do we want? And they were unanimous that we don't want a world that doesn't have brokenness in it, because they all said, we're broken. You know, I this generation of students is more willing to acknowledge they're broken and struggling than any I've ever had, Brian. And I think that's been a product of, in part, the reality culture they grew up in, but it's also been part of COVID's revealed that they don't have as much control over their lives as they thought they did. They're more sober, Brian, than they were 2 years ago.
Mm. Yeah, it will be interesting to see what the college and younger generation, the people coming of age during this time, the impact that COVID has. I mean, hopefully, there is this sense of understanding our inherent brokenness, compassion towards others. Yeah. I mean, so all these things that we lament we're missing from so many older people during the pandemic. you know, hopefully the younger generation is learning the value of some of these moral ideals.
Yeah, I hope so. I was talking with my students one day in class, and I realized I felt so disconnected from them because we were hybrid for a year. We were masked. Then I took a sabbatical in the fall, and I was just looking at them saying to myself, I don't know them anymore. And to me, education is always relational, just like I think learning, I think discipleship has to be relational. So I just canceled class for 2 days, and we went to the coffee shop at the college, and we just hung out and talked about who are we, what do we want to do with our lives. And I wove sociology into the mix, of course, but it was really about connecting with my students again. And it was a wonderful experience. And I heard more from them in those 2 days than I've ever heard in 30 years about when we get out of this place, we want to do something to help the world. And I was tremendously encouraged. I mean, I think in some ways the American dream has been obliterated. You know, that when they look out on the world, what they, in fact, before COVID, Brian, sometimes they told me this, they would ask one another, how are you doing today? And they'd say, I'm dead. And what they meant was because of, you know, climate change, the political polarization, not knowing if they can pay their tuition back, not knowing if they'll get a job in their field, they have been very pessimistic. But I think COVID reminded them that they can't take what they had for granted. And so we did very well here through COVID in terms of students cooperating. We did much better than the church did in terms of students just doing what they needed to do to get through. And so I was really encouraged by what I heard from my students a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, and I also appreciate what you mentioned there. When you're talking about, you gave the example of Denmark and, you know, sex ed, and we have this society where we have been, I think, increasingly kind of technocratic, right? It's this idea of how do we do things, and let's get right down to, you know, and not the big picture moral questions. And that's the role that the church is supposed to be playing in a society. And it seems that we're often just also on the step-by-step, do this, don't do this. You know, it's just maybe it's a different list of what to do or not to do than what we're seeing in Denmark or elsewhere. But it's we're not engaging in the big picture moral questions any more than our technocratic societies are.
Brian, I think you're exactly right. I think there's not only not a place in the public square for these conversations, there's not a place in the church. And so I teach a sociology of religion course. And a few years ago, I had my students, I'll teach it again this fall and do the same thing, tell their religious story. And using sociological concepts and perspectives, including those who were not religious. So I have students who are not religious, lots of them, but you can't grow up in this country without having some influence of religion upon you. So I wanted to hear what they shared about what they grew up with in terms of religion or not being religious in their context. And it was an amazing experience because there was no judgment. It was simply, this is my story. And I had a student who was a devout atheist who at the end of the class period said, I've listened to my Catholic friends and my evangelical friends, and I'm wondering if I might not again start to believe in God. He said, I thought everyone who was a Christian was a Trump supporter. And so it was this amazing moment where I thought, could we create this context in the church where it is safe to say, as I do in chapter one of the first book, this is my story, this is my song. It's not your story, it's not your song, but if we're going to develop community in any kind of meaningful way, it's going to have to begin with creating space for our stories, even if our stories don't line up with the same as one another, and they're not going to because our society is so diverse and heterogeneous. So I think the church really struggles with that. I struggled with it as a pastor. How do I create a space where the labels are gone, the creedal statements matter less? I've gone to saying I don't believe in belief statements anymore, Brian. You know, I was working with an organization recently that brought me in as a consultant, and they said we want to develop a new belief statement because we want to essentially keep certain people in and certain people out. I said, I don't ever begin with belief statements. I begin with the question of who has God called you to be and become? The statement of mission, the statement of calling. And they said, okay, that's fine. Well, I got cornered, Brian. You know, they insisted that we go back to the belief statement because, you know, we need to screen out who shouldn't be part of us. It wasn't about belief. It was about exclusion. And so I just think the church has really, yes, it's very, very difficult for the church. I went to the grocery store yesterday and my wife laughed when she came out because I told her the story. But I was parked in a particular place and this guy motioned for me to move and there was no reason for me to move. And I sat there and he yells words I can't repeat here. But he dropped the F-bomb on me. He didn't know me, but he labeled me for whatever reason for not moving. And she just laughed and said, some people have all the fun, Conrad, you always have this happen to you. But I thought that sometimes feels like the church, we just label one another because we do inconvenient things to one another. We believe inconvenient things. And I don't know how we remove some of those labels and begin to see each other as human beings. You know, when students come into my class, they've learned how to be successful students. We define somehow, they've learned how to be successful students. We have defined discipleship in the church as basically baptism instruction, confirmation class, or whatever, and then you're good to go. But we haven't socialized one another how to live together well, how to live together as human beings who are broken and flawed. When I went to Rock Steady Boxing, which is where I have gone to box with my Parkinson's friends. It's a program for Parkinson's folks. And when I walked in the door, they said, "Are you one of us? Will you join our team? And will we see you next week?" And I took that back to church and I said, could we develop those questions? Are you one of us? Not, are you just like the way we dress? Do you smell as good as us? Do you talk like we talk? But are you one of us in our brokenness? Are you one of us in our failures? Are you one of us in our beat upness? If you are, get in here because this is where you belong. That's church, Brian. But it seems like it's so hard for us to get there.
Yeah, it seems like, it's easier to draw those boundary lines, right, for exclusion than it is to stop and listen to the stories, which are, messier and have plot twists. And it takes more time to live in stories. Although you're a sociologist, so of course you love stories. You mentioned Berger a couple of times, and I've got one of his books over here on my bookshelf here on the side. So I know that
good
stories speak to you. But the Bible is also much more a book of stories than it is of do's and don'ts and thou shalls and thou shalt nots.
I mean, that if you look at Jesus' life, it was a life of storytelling. It was a storytelling of stories right where people were in their lived realities. So you're exactly right. It is easier to create a checklist of beliefs and to say, okay, we've checked the boxes and you're in, than it is to really hear one another. But then that also means we never go deep with each other. We don't understand one another. And I don't think we can really be church without being a community that listens closely to one another. Walter Brueggemann says, the first commandment is not thou shalt not have any other gods, but the first commandment is Deuteronomy 6, listen. Listen, the Lord our God is one. And that listen is so much needed in the church. Listen, because I think the way we fail to listen to each other is also the way we fail to listen to God. I think I've often told our congregation, if we all practiced a life with God, I think we can work through anything together. I think no matter the theological debate, no matter if we are walking, if we have what I have called a life with God, however you define that, but a connection to the God of the text, then I think God's going to help us walk through this stuff. But I heard far too many people, Brian, just tell me I never read the scripture. I never read the Bible. And I'm not talking about it from a legalistic point. I'm talking about just hearing what God's doing in the text, what God's saying in the text. And understanding that for our lives today. And if we aren't people of the text, we'll never be people that are truly church.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation, but first a quick word from a friend.
Hi, I'm Corey Nathan, and I host the Talking Politics and Religion Without Killing Each Other podcast. You can find us at politicsandreligion.us. That's politicsandreligion.us. We are your home for edifying, provocative, and fun discussions among high-profile public figures and regular folks like me. We talk about faith and politics and all kinds of topics that really matter in our culture. So if you're tired of screamers and extremists dominating the conversation and you want to join us in taking some of that space back, if you want to better understand different points of view, if you appreciate some nuance and just having a little fun, you'll love Talking Politics and Religion Without Killing Each Other. And remember, we're real easy to find. It's politicsandreligion.us. Hope to see you soon. We'd love to have you join the conversation on Talking Politics and Religion Without Killing Each Other.
So the subtitle to your first book in the series is a question, and I wanted to pose the question to you. And I know you wrote a whole book on it, so you know we'll give the short answer here. But you asked, why is God taking apart the church?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think that's a great question. I also love the idea that you are framing this that maybe God is speaking to us in this moment in the same way that you talked about, you know, Parkinson's personally. So why is God taking apart the church in this moment?
So when I was getting a shower, Brian, when I heard this question, it was 2006 and seven. I was in the middle of this mess of my denomination. The data, we were losing members and decline everywhere, systemic racism, on and on. And I remember hearing, just this question came to me, what if the Spirit of God is dismantling the church because we have so failed the mission of God to love the world that God so loved and so loves still? I know it's a long question, but why? What if God is dismantling the church because we have so failed to love the world as God so loves the world and loves it still? And that's my question. Where has the mission of God broken down in the church? Where have we failed to love neighbor as we love ourselves? You know, I think the gospel at its heart is simple. It's love Jesus and love neighbor. And we've mantled it up with lots of other things around us. And so I think it's about the mission of God. So I think when God took the people of Israel, clearly says, I'm bringing Nebuchadnezzar down. So some people challenge me by saying, God didn't give you Parkinson's disease. God would never do that. He's a God of love and a God of health and wealth. God would never dismantle the church. And I say, look at the book of Jeremiah. God says, I'm bringing Nebuchadnezzar down. I'm bringing your worst enemy down to take you into your worst nightmare. And then they get up there and they're clearly restless like we are restless. And Jeremiah writes this beautiful letter and says, just hang out, just chill out in Babylon, have a party in Babylon, raise your kids, have families, plant gardens, and bring shalom to the city. Bring my reign, my order, my life, my compassion, my empathy to your neighbors, because if you do that, it's going to come back to you. And I don't think that's a I think God was saying that if the people of God expected shalom, they had to offer shalom to their worst enemy. What God did was create a missional moment. What God did was put his people into mission in the midst of their enemies. And so why does God take apart the church? I think God wants to put us in mission again in the midst of what we see as our worst nightmare, so that we receive shalom back. But if we just turn inward and keep asking inward questions about who we are and how we protect ourselves from the world, I don't think shalom will ever show up at our front door, Brian. And if we expect it to show up at our front door, that's going to be a requirement. If we do not bring shalom, if we turn inward as a church, if we fight the culture wars, if we fail to love neighbor, we will continue to experience chaos and conflict and the disorientation, dislocation that I think we're currently experiencing.
And then in your third book, you talk about this idea of a God in the dark. Right? Does God even hear us? Is he there? And I wonder if you can talk about that sentiment, because I think it's one that a lot of people experience. We don't always like to admit it or talk about it, but especially over these last couple of years, it seems like this is something that people have wondered, God, are you even there? Where are you, God? And this is something that you're definitely writing about and acknowledging.
Yeah, It's a great question. And I have to say, over the last 4 weeks, I have been interviewing Walter Brueggemann nonstop and people he's connected with me too, who know him. And he would say that the role of the Psalms is to call God to become God. So I'm reading Psalm 3 this morning as David is getting chased by his son Absalom. And he says, rise up, O God. You know, he's like, he's telling God to live into the reality of being God. Now, I don't think it's, I don't know what that means theologically, but it runs throughout the Old Testament where we are called upon to call God to be God. And so I think there is, at least within us deeply, this sense that God, Brian, my experience is just, my story is this. There have been moments where I wondered where God was. There were certainly moments when I was struggling as a kid with the terror of God's wrath. I often say it's amazing that I still believe there is a God who loves, because what I experienced as a kid should have sent me the other direction. What I know is that God has shown up for me enough moments of my life to keep me on the journey and believing that he will keep showing up. But why I don't always experience God showing up, why there is pain in the world, I can't answer those questions. I only know from my lived experience that enough of the times when I have needed assurance that there is more than just this me in this world alone, God has been present. But sometimes, and I remember when my wife was, Heidi was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, I went running, screaming down the street one evening in the dark, just saying, God, just yelling at God, you know, just doing the psalmist thing, saying, why would you allow this? Why are you doing this? You know, what, who are you? And I think God calls us, God would prefer that we be in dialogue with God, even when we're angry with God, than that we mantle up our mouths and shut our mouths to God. So I can't answer the question of where God is, or I just know that God invites us always to be in this dialogic relationship with God. And there's something about that dialogical relationship that creates the reality that perhaps motivates God to be God. I don't know. I mean, I can sound heretical, and I know that's, but I, when I look at the Psalms in the Old Testament, that's what the saints did. They called upon God to be God and to rise up and fight on their behalf. And I think we pray these timid little prayers like, your will be done, and, you know, whatever, whatever, whatever. And if you want to do this, well, the Psalms called on God to be God, you know, get your act together, God, and come on our behalf. And there's something about that that is very Jewish. Jewish theology is often in some ways a protest against God. But I think as Christians, we've missed that and have lived unempowered lives because we've not called upon God to be God.
I love that word. I think that's such a great note for us to end on. And so my last question for you is, where can people find more about you and your books? And then I wonder if you can give us a little taste. You mentioned that the fifth book in the quintology, I'm making this word up, so I'm going to copyright it right now. What's the next book? Give us a little taste of where you're going.
The next book is called What in God's Name is Happening to the Church? And it's really addressing this question that I keep hearing. Why would God do this? Why? This can't be true. This can't be true that God would destroy the church, that God would give you Parkinson's. I keep getting that feedback. And so it's really addressing the question you just asked me. Why do I believe that God is up to this in the world? I will address it from a sociological perspective, but also a deeply theological perspective and a personal perspective. And then it will also include a set of essays that are unpublished, that have been podcast blogs, that are based around the themes of trying to address this question, what is God up to in the world? So it'll be a similar layout, but it'll be new material, and it will really begin with a set of essays about what in God's name is happening to the church.
And people can find more about you and all of that?
Yeah, people can find more at my website, www.churchdismantled.com has about everything that I'm doing there. I've got a podcast, I've got a blog. I'm doing webinars, so I'm doing 6 webinars yet this year. People can sign up for those webinars. They're on where are the kids in a dismantled church, addressing religious trauma in a dismantled church, growing old in a dismantled church, dismantling the mission of a dismantled church. Just addressing themes of the books. I've got a really good response to these in the past several months. And they're 5-hour webinars. You can get the recordings of them too. But we just go deeper, Brian, with the questions that we're looking at, because this has tapped into, I've been taken by surprise, tapped into, I hear a lot, you put into words questions I've been wrestling with. And these webinars are learning communities. I say this is a classroom, not a church. We're coming here to learn together, to listen together, to hear stories together. There's always one or two specialists I speak, and it's always a panel of pastors. These are geared towards people on the ground who are working at these issues as well. So www.churchdismantled.com.
Well, great. Well, thank you, Conrad, so much for joining us on the program to talk about your book series and the podcast, A Church Dismantled. Really appreciate it. And thanks for all the work that you've been doing and helping us to think about this really critical and important time that we find ourselves in.
Ryan, thank you. It's been a delight. Blessings to you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.